Members, the Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Mariani.
Present.
Mariani present. Frazier. Frazier. Johnson. Johnson present. Adelson.
Present.
Adelson present. Feist.
Present.
Feist present. Hollins.
Present.
Hollins present. Hewatt.
Present.
Hewatt present. Cleburne.
Present.
Cleburne present. Long.
Present.
Long present. Lucero.
Busy morning in IT security so far.
Lucero present. Mueller.
Mueller present.
Sorry. Mueller present. Novotny.
Novotny present.
Novotny present. O'Neill.
Present and ready to participate today.
O'Neill present. Pinto.
Present.
Pinto present. Poston.
Present.
Poston present. Raleigh.
Raleigh present and motivated.
Raleigh present. Vang.
Present.
Vang present. Zhang J.
Don Klaus is present, if it's me.
Wang J present.
Zhang J present. Frazier.
Present.
Frazier present. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ursula. I'm sorry, I should have been paying close attention. Did you call Grossel, Representative Grossel's name?
Representative Grossel is excused.
Okay, all right. I just want to make sure that we didn't skip over. All right, very well. Members, there is a quorum. I do want to thank Ursula for pitching in today to help. We have excellent staff at the Minnesota House that works very collaboratively and supportive of one another. They set a good example, and they do really good work. And Ursula, you and I have served in this institution for a long time together, so thank you for your work and for being helpful with us today, no doubt on short notice. I do believe that Ms. Ogunfalami will be with us soon. She's been quite ill, but I hear that she's on the mend. So your prayers of thoughts and healing are having a difference. Look forward to having her back. Members, we don't have minutes for today, but we will next time we meet. And so we will dispense with adoption of the minutes. We do have today's agenda is a little bit full. There are four bills. I have a simple bill that hopefully we can just dispense with quite quickly. And then we have three bills that I think we should spend good time having conversation with one another. House File 640, Representative Gomez, House File 75, Representative Mueller, and then House File 237, Representative Quam. So members, with that, I am going to go ahead and I'll keep the gavel for this because my hope is, quite frankly, this will be pretty quick. The chair moves that House File 729 be referred to the General Register. House File 729 is before us. Members, this is a really pretty simple bill. It does nothing else, excuse me, than to change the name of the council that we created in last year's Minnesota Police Accountability Act. It's currently called the Ensuring Police Excellence and Improving Community Relations Advisory Council. And that's within the Pulse Board. And so the bill will change that to peace officer, to the Peace Officer Standards and Training, so POST Board Citizen Council. And members, just to be totally transparent, I actually don't expect, you know, this bill to actually change their name, even though I think it should. You know, quite frankly, I'm looking to make sure that we've got a good alternative bill on the floor in case that's needed for the important work that we push out. Those are commonly referred to in common language as vehicle bills. Representative Johnson, as former chair of this committee, understands, you know, the importance and wisdom of having those kind of bills. So, members, discussion. Very well. Seeing no discussion, the chair renews his motion at House File
7. Chair Mariani, my hand is
up. I'm sorry, Representative Johnson. Let me. Oh, you know what? I didn't screen all the way up. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I'm just wondering if you could explain why you're removing the word advisory. Once you start doing that, that changes the aspect of the board from being advice to actually having a lot more authority than they were originally intended to have. I'm just wondering what the reason for that is, because this is just the advisory board.
Representative Johnson, actually, this board is a little bit more than advisory. The language that I'm proposing in the bill is the original language that we had for this bill coming out of this committee that we voted for as a House when we sent the bill over to the other body. Obviously, those negotiations created a different title. As you'll recall, this council has the authority to place agendas before the Pulse Board with the board required to act on their recommendations, not to accept them, not to accept them unedited. But unlike a typical advisory where information is provided to a body and that body can choose to ignore it, the powers of this board allow it, in fact, expect it because of the important nature of the work that they do to be able to have their recommendations, in fact, acted on by the board. And so, again, I gave you my intended purpose for the bill, but there is a an important substantive reason that goes to the way that this council was constructed, and we will no doubt if this bill is used for the potential purpose, we'll no doubt have that conversation with my counterpart in the other body.
Yes, I understand that, but I've been on a number of advisory boards, whether it's through the legislature or in my personal life. And whenever an advisory board makes a recommendation to the full board, those are always discussed. That's part of the process. And I see no need to be changing this name. What I see is this is a vehicle to change the concept of that board, whether it's next year or the year after. And I do have a problem with that because I believe this board should stay as an advisory board to Pulse Board.
Representative Johnson, your comments are noted. Again, I will only reiterate that nothing in this bill changes the charge to that board and its relationship to that council and its relationship to the Pulse Board. And as I explained earlier, it was constructed in such a way that its recommendations not only must be heard, they must be acted upon by the Pulse Board. Any further discussion? If not, the chair renews his motion. House File 729 will be referred to the General Registry. The clerk will take the roll. The clerk might be muted.
Yep, sorry.
It's quite all right.
Mariani.
Aye.
Frazier.
Aye.
Johnson.
No.
Edelson.
Aye.
Feist.
Aye.
Russell excuse. Collins.
Aye.
Hewat.
Aye.
Cleborne.
Aye.
Yes.
Long.
Aye.
Lucero. Lucero. Mueller.
Mueller votes no.
Novotny.
No.
O'Neill.
No.
Pinto.
Aye.
Poston.
No.
Raleigh.
Raleigh's a no.
Vane.
Aye.
Zhang.
Aye.
Lucero's a no.
Okay. There is 11 ayes and 7 noes.
Very well. Members, House File 729 on a vote of 11 ayes and 7 noes is referred to the committee, or rather to the General Register. Members, the next bill up is House File 640, Representative Gomez. And the chair will move House File 640, and let me check. The motion is to refer House File 640 to the Committee on Judiciary. So that is the chair's motion. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and good morning to the
committee. Good morning.
I appreciate the chance to present this bill to you. So House File 640 establishes civilian oversight councils of law enforcement in the state. This summer, our state and my district in particular was the site of the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers. And it turned into the epicenter of a global reckoning and an uprising of people demanding justice and fairness in their interactions with law enforcement. This committee and its previous incarnation undertook the huge and time-consuming effort of putting together a police reform package that I believe the chair went over during your first meeting. What's in front of you today for consideration is one of the components of that package that we discussed this summer that didn't make it over the line, but remains vitally important to our efforts to make real progress in improving accountability and relationships between police and the communities that they serve. This bill would establish civilian review authorities in all departments that have more than 50 sworn officers. So out of the 300 plus law enforcement departments in the state of Minnesota, this would impact about 40 of them. Other than that, if a city or a municipality had a lower number of sworn officers and wanted to establish one of these councils, they could do that. Under current law, civilian review authorities are barred from conducting independent investigations or issuing their own findings of fact, which means that was a change that happened in 2012. So that kind of really constrained civilian review authority in our state, so that they rely very heavily on the participation of and information provided by law enforcement agencies themselves. So what our community sees when they look at the oversight apparatus that exists, and this is in my city, like this is the experience that I have, right? And so I represent Minneapolis. I understand that it's not going to be the same everywhere, but the current oversight apparatus in my city looks to the public like a body that takes action, that takes disciplinary action, and that sustains complaints at an incredibly low rate. Only about 2.7% of complaints filed between 2013 and 2019 were sustained, even while our residents pay, in some cases, up to tens of millions of dollars in settlements related to police misconduct. They see that over the last decade, it's taken MPD an average of a year and a half to process any misconduct complaint, and that citizens and journalists have trouble accessing data that is public under Chapter 13, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. In sum, we rely heavily on police departments to regulate themselves based on information that is generated not by an investigation by an impartial outside body, but by the department itself. In 1998, Human Rights Watch published a report on police brutality in Minneapolis and many other cities and had this conclusion, which I think is like really kind of encapsulates a lot of the issues that we deal with here. It says, officers who repeatedly commit human rights violations tend to be a small minority who taint entire police departments, but are protected routinely by the silence of their fellow officers and by flawed systems of reporting, oversight, and accountability. Although the officers who repeatedly engage in misconduct or human rights abuses are very, very few in number, their impact is just so significant, it's hard to overstate. I grew up in South Minneapolis, I grew up in the district that I represent, and when I was like, in maybe middle school, so that was like the early 90s, two Minneapolis police officers handcuffed two Native American men who were intoxicated. They put these two men in the trunk of their squad car, closed the trunk on them, and gave them a rough ride around town. It's been almost 25 years since this happened, like a whole lifetime. And people in the community still talk about it, especially people in the Native community. Especially people in the geography where it took place, which is close to where I live. I bring up this incident because, you know, as a young person coming up, it was formative for me and for my peers and for other people in the community in the way that we viewed law enforcement, what their function was in our community, and what type of treatment we could expect to receive from them if we interacted with them. It spread fear and mistrust. And a single incident like this, right, done by two officers, can have just this incredibly deep and long-lasting and far-reaching, corrosive and poisonous impact on our communities and on police-community relations. So the impacts of a really terrible but isolated incident like this are magnified incredibly in the absence of any meaningful oversight. Because what our community saw was that the public coffers paid out money for this. It was something that we could all agree was just like super egregious. I don't think anybody would say this was the kind of conduct that anyone expects from law enforcement or from any agent of any government toward residents. But there was no accountability. The officers remained on the force. They still were in the community where this had taken place. If residents don't feel safe interacting with law enforcement because of the actions of this very small number of officers who've not been held accountable, we can't expect them to cooperate with investigations. People won't call 911 when they've been the victim of a crime. They won't cooperate with when information is needed. This makes all of us less safe. I mean, we ask a great deal of officers and we give them great power. And I know it from Spider-Man, but with great power comes great responsibility. I'm sure that it has another source in the culture, but that's how I came to know that. Unfortunately, we're in this situation. We have to deal with where we are, which is trust has been broken between large swaths of our community and law enforcement. There is no way that law enforcement can do the job that we ask them to do and that they want to do and that they show up every day to do to keep the communities that they serve safe if we do not have basic and transparent systems of civilian accountability in place. And just in closing, I want to say, you know, civilian review is not a punishment. I think we had some conversations this summer from some of the representatives. I believe maybe Representative O'Neill talked about, you know, her county sheriff's office, and, you know, that they would fall, they have more than 50 sworn officers, so they would fall into kind of being included in this. And, you know, she was like, well, I mean, we have, there's actually, like, they do a really good job. They have really great relationships with the community. And so, you know, didn't feel like this was necessary. But I guess I would just ask us to kind of, like, reorient ourselves to this effort. It doesn't need to be considered punitive. Instead, it's an acknowledgement that broadly, we're not where we all want to be with respect to relationships between our communities and law enforcement. And that if we don't put new strategies in place that actually make citizens feel confident that when they interact with a police officer and something goes wrong, there will be accountability, we're not going to be able to get to the place that we want. You know, absent an impartial and empowered civilian oversight entity, we're not going to have the public safety system that we all want in the state of Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to take any questions. I have a testifier first. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. And thank you for quoting Stan Lee in my committee. My day is now complete, I must say. Representative Gomez, I think before your testifiers, there is an A2 amendment. I think that might be an author's amendment. And so I'm just inquiring whether you want the chair to move that or not.
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to address it briefly if you'd like. But
very well. Thank you. The chair then moves the A2 amendment to House File 640. A2 amendment is before us, Representative Gomez.
So this was actually just getting the language that I introduced didn't reflect the final engrossment of the bill that we'd been working on over the summer. And so I made some modifications to that initial language based on conversations that I had. Initially it didn't have the 50 officer threshold. I added that. I think the part about the guidance for best practices for oversight council members was something that Representative Johnson suggested. And then, you know, it gets rid of an article that wasn't supposed to be in there. But if anybody has any specific questions about the author's amendment, I'm happy to answer them.
Very well. So, Representative Gomez, it sounds like the bill, I should have done this at the beginning, it sounds like it basically puts the bill in the form that the author wishes to have us before us. Is that correct?
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Members, unless there's objection, we can dispense with a roll call on that and just do a voice vote to get the bill in the shape of the author wishes to have before us. I'll call on our minority.
Chair Mariani, that would be fine.
Johnson for his advice.
That would be fine, Chair.
Okay, very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Members, all in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. And the House File 640 is amended, as amended is now before us. Representative Gomez, I think it's probably good for you to, this would be a good time, rather, for you to move with your witnesses. Please feel free to call forward who that might be.
Michelle Gross with Communities United Against Police Brutality is here.
Very well. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Gross, good to see you again. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Mariani and members. My name is Michelle Gross, and I am one of the founders and currently the president of the organization Communities United Against Police Brutality. We are an all-volunteer organization that just celebrated our 20th anniversary, and we are based in the Twin Cities, but we work throughout the state. Basically, I'm here to talk just a little bit about this bill. Earlier this week, I I tuned in because we were going to hear the bill back earlier in the week, and I listened patiently to the testimony and the discussion of House File 445, which is a bill on funding a multi-jurisdictional response to protests last summer. And what I think was missing from that discussion was why those protests happened in the first place and why this particular bill is essential. Long before Derek Chauvin was in a position to snuff out the life of George Floyd with his knee on George Floyd's neck, he had 17 complaints against him. Others had been harmed by him and nearly lost their lives, but failed to even report his actions for fear of retaliation. There was an article just 2 days ago in the New York Times that outlined the cases of seven of those people, none of whom had actually filed the complaint against him. Further, you know, some of them even cited the futility of attempting to complain against him. And let me explain why. Back when Statute 626.89 Subdivision 17 came into being in 2012, the city of Minneapolis used that as the excuse to shut down our civilian review authority and replace it with what's called the Office of Police Conduct Review. When the civilian review authority was operating, it had a discipline rate similar to the national average of for civilian oversight bodies, which is 7 to 8%, according to Samuel Walker, the civilian oversight expert. In the 8 years since the Office of Police Conduct Review began its operations, it has taken in 3,133 complaints and disciplined 12. That's a discipline rate of 0.42%, less than half of 1%. The three complaints filed against Derek Chauvin to the Civilian Review Authority were upheld and disciplined. By contrast, none of the other complaints that were filed against Derek Chauvin through the Office of Police Conduct Review were ever disciplined. A robust civilian oversight mechanism is a very important check on the powers of police. Robust civilian oversight ensures accountability, but more importantly, is a key mechanism to reduce liability and future bad conduct. Without robust civilian oversight, there are no such checks. In addition, civilian oversight bodies can provide recommendations for policies, and in fact, our Civilian Review Authority used to do exactly that, provide recommendations on policies that would reduce the number of misconduct incidents of police. So it's an important mechanism, not just for disciplining officers, which should be the last thing down the road, but it's an important mechanism for moving upstream to stop those incidents from happening in the first place. So this is very important to the community. You know, we participated in a national study of civilian oversight mechanisms in the state of Minnesota, documenting virtually every single police department's mechanism and law enforcement department's mechanism for addressing complaints. And what we found is that very few had a means for filing online. Very few had a means, even an outlined process for addressing complaints. Many of them just said, well, you have to talk to the chief, you know, and that sort of thing. This is not an appropriate way to address complaints against police. You know, there's an argument sometimes that police make that say, well, you just can't understand our job. Civilians can't understand our job. What you have to remember, though, is I worked in healthcare for 40 years, and nurses and doctors, their misconduct, alleged misconduct, came before juries of average, ordinary members of the community, and they were able to make good decisions on whether the healthcare provider engaged in bad conduct. You know, we rely on that for healthcare, which is a complex area also. I think that properly trained civilians have every ability to make good decisions about the conduct of police, the very police systems that we live under. And this is, you know, not small. During the hearing earlier in the week on House File 445, there was a talk about, you know, practices around riot prevention. I submit to you that the best riot prevention is to prevent the bad conduct in the first place. You know, it's not for nothing that people were protesting. I don't support riots. I don't support, you know, violent conduct. But it's not for nothing that people were protesting the death of George Floyd. People saw in living color a man have his life snuffed out in front of him while there were a group of people begging that officer to take his knee off and watching him as he kept his knee on and grinding it deeper. We can't have officers like Derek Chauvin on our force. Had we had robust civilian oversight, his continued conduct would likely have been addressed in a way that would have prevented him from ever having the opportunity to put his knee on George Floyd's neck. This is absolutely essential to the community. You have to have checks and balances for anyone who has power, especially for any group of people who has power to take away a member of the community's life. We have to have this. So I implore you to please move this bill forward so that it can get a hearing on the floor. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Grouse, and hopefully you'll be able to stick around for questions and discussion. I already have six members whose hands are up. And members, I will get to you, but I want to make sure we get our testimony in first. Representative Gomez, I don't have anyone else on the list testifying on behalf of the bill. There are two other individuals who do want to speak to the bill from our law enforcement communities. But before we move to them, I just want to check with you if you have any other testifiers.
Nope, we're good to move on to the other testimony, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Gomez. So we have two testifiers, Chief Eric Werner from the Maple Grove Police Department, and then Sheriff Bill Hutton with the Minnesota Sheriff Association. So let's do that in that order. Chief Werner, welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record, and please provide your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I first want to say thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Eric Werner. I'm the current vice president for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, and I'm also the chief of police for the city of Maple Grove. I am speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, who represents more than 300 police chiefs across the state and over 150 command staff members. I just want to start by saying that the Chiefs of Police Association does support the development of partnerships between police departments and their communities that they serve. This helps to create more transparency and fosters trusting relationships as police and community work together. In fact, many of our members already have implemented various forms of civilian advisory or oversight boards in their communities. We believe there are many ways to accomplish this work, therefore we feel it should be left to each municipality to determine what works best for their community and agency. House File 640 includes several provisions that work well for large municipalities, however, they may not work well in some of our smaller municipalities or vice versa. In particular, we have concerns about granting subpoena powers on discipline cases. We at the Chiefs Association believe that the development of civilian review and oversight boards should be done in partnership with individual community and their police agencies. So, Mr. Chair, for those reasons, the Chiefs of Police Association does not support this bill. But we do want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief, and congratulations as well on your, I think that's a recent development in your leadership of the Chiefs of Police Association. Very super quick question. Does your jurisdiction have a oversight or advisory council, Maple Grove?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the city of Maple Grove has what's called a citizens advisory committee for the entire city. So they do have matters of the police can be brought before that committee.
Okay. Thank you, sir. And I take it you're able to stick around for any questions as well?
Mr. Chair, I can.
Thank you, Chief. With that, Sheriff Bill Hutton of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and provide your testimony, please.
All right. Good morning, Chair Mariani, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to be in front of you on House File 640. I am Bill Hutton, Executive Director of Minnesota Sheriff's Association, representing the 87 elected sheriffs of Minnesota. I am also a three-term retired sheriff from Washington County, and I have 35 years in public safety. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association does not support House File 640. Do we think it is a good idea for agencies to have citizens advisory committee? Yes, absolutely. As laid out in this bill, no. As we heard, one size does not fit all. We heard that message from Renville County Sheriff Scott Hable last week. He stated, we know our community. Our kids go to school together and we go to church together. Those of you that live or have lived in a community outside of the metro know exactly what he was saying. Citizens advisory committees are happening throughout the state. Hennepin County Sheriff's Office has a very robust committee, and others, and many others do as well. Dakota County Sheriff's Office has a very active advisory committee as well. They meet regularly to review policy programs, the use of their drone, community engagement. I have talked to the sheriff, Sheriff Leslie, many times about his committee. He says it's a great sounding board. They are helpful and insightful, but it is an elected's responsibility. House File 640 is shifting or taking the authority away from the elected officials and placing it in the hands of a, as stated by Representative Gomez, a trained committee. But again, it is not that of the, not an elected body. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association believes this is a local decision. This discussion should be happening at the local level by the local elected officials. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association doesn't support as the way it is presented. Thank you, Chair, for your time.
Thank you, Sheriff Hutton. And sir, I take it you'll be able to stick around for questions as well.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Sheriff. Members, I don't have anyone else on the testimony list. Okay, very well. So with that, why don't we open up for questions and discussion? I have six members, and my hope is to get through all six of you. We'll begin with Representative Johnson, then Vice Chair Frazier, and Representative O'Neill to get us started. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani. Representative Gomez, I want to thank you for bringing this up for discussion. I have a few questions on this bill. We discussed it last year, and it didn't, and it hasn't changed that much. One of the most important things that should be required on these boards, especially if they're going to set policy, and I believe that's one of the things you have in here, and is they should have some understanding and training of law enforcement, how it works. In the law enforcement community, we are regularly looking at best practices and things that work, continuously changing and changing our training in order to get the things that work. Departments that don't do that, we see those issues like what's happening in Minneapolis. They haven't changed their policies, and the policies are set by the city council and the mayor, and not by the police chief. We can make recommendations. They can't. You also talked about the failure of different things. I'm just reading the Minneapolis Police Conduct Review Panel, what they do. The biggest problem they're having right now is vacancies. Out of nine civilian members, they only have four empty. Five of the seats are set, come from just one ward, the 8th ward, and then one out of the 10th. It's interesting that the mayor has picked three people from the same ward and not the full representation of the city of Minneapolis for the rest of that board. Also, if you actually do it, look at what the responsibilities are. The police review board takes after the investigation, and the investigations do take time. They look at it. Then two members of the board are appointed along with two representatives of the department who actually did the investigation or part of it. They review it and make a recommendation to the board, which then goes to the police chief. You mentioned one individual had 18 complaints and only a couple that were disciplinary. It very well could be that those complaints are unfounded. In the law enforcement world, over 99% of complaints filed are unfounded once they're investigated. So it's just a small percentage, and even a small percentage arbitrated or contested. And the other thing is, we have no idea what those actual complaints were. You can look at somebody, an officer's record. They might have 24 complaints, all unfounded, with no disciplinary because there was no true complaint. But in his record, it still shows 24 complaints. Unfortunately, I believe those should not be available to the public if they're not the actual true complaints. But that's for another story. The other issue, one of the testifiers, Ms. Gross, stated, talked about it, the city's paying out for on complaints without even fighting them. Unfortunately, a lot of insurance companies do pay out because it's cheaper to pay out than actually fight. And unfortunately, the officer does not have any say in that. Even if the officer was right in what he did, whether it's a complaint or not, the insurance company pays out, then it's a bad reflection on the officer who might have done nothing actually wrong. Now, getting to these civilian review boards, if they work, they're great. Minneapolis has had one for decades, and it has failed because they can't get anybody to be on it. Out of nine positions, they have five or four that are open, and they've been open for a long time. We have to make sure that if they do these boards, and unfortunately your bill doesn't require any training, should be properly trained, as Ms. Gross said, in the police tactics and understanding of law enforcement. So I have a lot of issues with this bill in its current form still. And with that, I can't support this at this time.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. You raised a number of issues. I'll turn to the testifiers to respond to some of that, then we'll move on to Representative Frazier. Ms. Gross, it seems to me that you may have some thoughts on some of the issues that Representative Johnson raised, because I think part of that was in reference to information that you've provided. So I'm wondering if, and just to provide a little focus here, and perhaps Representative Gomez or might also comment on this. It does seem to me that there are some important data privacy issues. That's true at our state board as well, that constantly needs to be balanced off here. But I am also struck, and Representative Johnson said it, that sometimes folks have no idea, you know, what the complaint is or what the issue is. But it seems to me that it goes to the crux of the matter. If trust is based on transparency, then perhaps we need to work to have greater transparency so that we know whether something is, you know, valid or a perceptual issue that can be talked about and then worked through. It seems to me that's part of what citizen councils, oversight councils ought to do, but I don't have experience with them directly. So perhaps, Ms. Gross, if you can comment quickly, and then I'd invite the other testifiers to comment as well.
Yes, Chair Mariani and members, thank you. Representative Johnson is correct that there were some vacancies for a period of time. All of those vacancies have actually been filled since then. The city of Minneapolis has a kind of a strange process where they only fill vacancies twice a year. And so there was some issue. He was referring, though, to the Police Conduct Oversight Commission, which is the body that looks at policies only and does not review complaints. The body, Office of Police Conduct Review, which examines complaints, actually was fully staffed in throughout the entirety. And so he's a little bit incorrect in that, with due respect, Representative Johnson. As to the other questions about insurance policies and things like that, you know, I didn't speak to that at all, but I can speak to it. Minneapolis is self-insured, as is St. Paul, Duluth, Rochester. I think those are the main four who are self-insured. And thus they make the decisions on whether or not to pay out for various claims. And paying out claims is very different than addressing complaints. Complaints that go to oversight bodies are not lawsuits. They are not subject to payouts of any type. They are simply complaints that people make. And the people who make these complaints don't expect to have a payout because that body isn't capable of doing that. They complain simply because, you know, it's an altruistic belief that they, by making that complaint, they won't, you know, they will prevent the next person from having the problem. And so it's a purely altruistic on their part. Now, are some complaints false? Yes, but not the 99% that he cited. Normal civilian oversight bodies across the U.S. have a 7 to 8% sustained and discipline rate. And that's, again, a Samuel Walker figure. And I consider that to be a little bit on the low side. But we have in Minneapolis less than half of 1% because we don't have civilian oversight. We have a body that's controlled at all levels by city staff and police. And basically what they do is they take even egregious complaints and shuffle them over to what they call coaching and counseling, which is not considered under state law to be a discipline. And thus the complaints are not publicly available. So under Minnesota Chapter 13, and I know I'm going a little long, I'll try to go quick. But under Chapter 13, a complaint that is sustained discipline and past the grief period, we can know everything about that complaint, including the nature of the complaint and the discipline. But under Chapter 13 and the Demers decision, if a complaint is not sustained, then all we can know about is the existence of the complaint, the name and badge number of the officer, and the name and contact information for the complainant. But we cannot know anything at all about the nature of the complaint or, you know, anything that happened in the process of adjudicating that complaint. And so, you know, that wouldn't change under this current bill. That would be something that would have to happen through, you know, some kind of review of Chapter 13 as well as the Demers decision. So that wouldn't change. What having robust civilian oversight does, with due respect to the representatives of law enforcement, is it provides a check for police conduct. Advisory boards, they're great, you know, but they are what they say, advisory, and they look at policies and things like that, and those are helpful. But you do need a civilian check on police conduct because police have, among state actors, they have more power than anyone. They have the power to take a person's life away. We need appropriate checks and balances on that power. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gross. And very quickly, Representative Gomez, if I read your bill correctly, the CLIO is not an obligation to agree with the recommendations of the council. That they, in fact, the CLIO can oppose those recommendations. And I've never met a shy CLIO, and I suspect that, you know, they'll do that for all sorts of good reasons. They certainly have gone up against arbitrators, for instance. But I think I'm correct in that. I do want to keep moving forward. We have Representative Frazier, then Representative O'Neill, followed by Representative Long. Representative Frazier.
Try to be quickly. First of all, Ms. Gross, thank you for talking about Chapter 13. I can always appreciate someone that has an understanding of Chapter 13.
There are very many of us.
I appreciate it.
That's one of my favorite chapters in the state statutes. Thank you.
I appreciate that. To me, this is the historical cycle that we have, right? Mm-hmm. We have something that happens in the community with our police officers, and then it's something that goes bad, and then we have a reaction, and we try to rein that thing in. And then it goes into this continued mistrust. To me, this bill, all it is trying to do, and the intention of it is to try to put situations where we can build trust with the community before those things happen. I mean, I believe if we have trust with the community and our law enforcement, we don't get to some of these actions that we see after an incident or an interaction happens the way we've seen in prior years. I think that's a very important thing. And what I do understand and what I hear from some of our other agencies in Greater Minnesota is that some of our smaller police agencies, they have these relationships in the community already. Some of them happen organically. And I think the bill is specific in pointing out the fact that they're focusing on our larger police departments that may not have these relationships and trying to foster and facilitate those relationships, which I think overall will create a better working environment, which could lead to better recruitment and retention of our police officers. And I think that's an important thing. And Ms. Gross, I guess that's more of a statement, but what I would submit to you is, do you agree with that position?
So, Ms. Gross, super quickly.
Yes, without question, I agree with everything you just said. We, you know, trust cannot be built by just words. They have to be built by actions. And that's what we're asking for here is actions.
All right, very well. And Representative Gomez, to Representative Frazier's point, and we've heard this repeatedly in this committee over the last few weeks, and we've gone out to try to talk to diverse perspectives in law enforcement. There are differences in size, culture, you know, relationships. Some of it having to do with the size of the or the number of officers. Your bill has a cutoff point of 50 officers in terms of the requirement for an oversight council. Is that correct, Representative Gomez?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right. Very well. Members, let's keep pushing. Representative O'Neill, and then I have Representative Long. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members and those that are listening virtually, let's just be really, really clear what we're doing here. We are forcing every single local government unit that has a law enforcement agency of 50 sworn officers or more, forcing them to put together this advisory council, but it is not purely advisory. They have, so let me read the language that we just added and you'll understand why they are not advisory. It says, at the conclusion of any criminal investigation or prosecution, if any citizen oversight council may conduct an investigation into the allegations, and it continues to go on to say that they may discipline. So if that local government has given them the authority to discipline an officer, after the investigation by law enforcement, the criminal investigation by the BCA or other law enforcement has already concluded, the prosecution has concluded, if this advisory council is not satisfied with that result, they can issue another investigation. They can have full subpoena power. So this is an unelected citizen board with who knows what kind of professionals that are on the board. There's no requirement for any kind of particular professional to be on the board that actually would have expertise in this sort of area. Full subpoena power. So it's a parallel universe to our criminal justice system. So they do the investigation, they have full subpoena power, and they may have a full disciplinary power over this law enforcement officer, who, by the way, has already gone through a criminal investigation or criminal prosecution. This is not advisory. This is not a robust citizen oversight council. This seems a little bit more like a very heavy-handed citizen group that can inflict discipline upon an officer even after a full investigation and prosecution has already concluded. That's what we're really talking about. That is why this is a one-size-fits-all, 50 officer or more, so yes, that includes Wright County, whereby in Wright County they have very, very, very few complaints. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it is very, very few complaints that come in to say that they were, that some officer abused their power. And even less are founded, less than five in some 30 years. So this is a one-size-fits-all. Every single agency with 50 sworn officers or more must put together this advisory council that literally have subpoena power, investigatory power, and potentially power to discipline officers after investigations have been done and prosecutions have been concluded. That's what we're really talking about. And I believe that's why two of our law enforcement associations have come. So the Sheriff's Association and the Chief of Police Association have come to speak against this because of the overreach of this, the ability to, for this oversight council to have complete and utter overreach. Again, you could have anybody you want. There is no requirement for number of people on this council. There is no requirement that you have professionals from the community that have any idea what they're doing. So for that reason and so many others, we have opposed this last time it came up, and we are absolutely opposing this again now. And I'm not sure why we're spending time to do something that's so highly controversial, but here we are, members. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. I do want to hold on a second, Ms. Gross. I do want to apologize to the committee because you know I try to keep moving things moving along, and I think that sometimes that puts us in a bit of a rush. But I do want to point out, Representative O'Neill, that on line 114 of the A2 amendment, and probably because you were in a rush, you skipped over some pretty important language that actually qualifies your concern, and without minimizing your heartfelt concern, but it's important to make sure that the record reflects. And on line 14.14, it reads, if the governing body grants a council the authority, the council may impose discipline on peace officers employed by the agency. And of course, the governing body is an elected body. So it's really important, members, that we take all the information before us. It still may well not deter anyone from voting for or against anything, but it's really important that I think the author, that we respect the author's, work to be able to craft the legislation that they want us to vote on and not something else. Ms. Gross, you had something very quickly?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Mariani. With due respect, Representative O'Neill, the civilian oversight bodies don't look at actions related to lawbreaking. Basically, if an officer is accused of something that would violate the law, like, say, sexual assault or something like that, those are properly handled in the arena of the judicial system. What civilian oversight bodies consider are violations of policies of the department itself. Those are the areas that they look at because they don't have any power to address lawbreaking. And so there wouldn't be any reason. If an act is sort of marginal, like maybe it's lawbreaking or whatever, that would always go to the judicial system to address the criminal justice system. The civilian oversight bodies only look at policies of the department and whether those policies have been violated. So I wanted to make that clarification. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, yes, I've called on the other testifiers to comment as well. So I just wanted to take a quick pause to see if any other testifiers wish to respond or comment on this current theme.
Mr. Chair, if I could actually read the language of the bill, that is in complete contradiction to what you just said.
Representative O'Neill, I read the language of the bill verbatim to the committee, so that's already been done.
A different line, Mr. Chair.
Well, go ahead, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Line 1.8, it said, at the conclusion of any criminal investigation or prosecution, if any, a citizen oversight council may conduct an investigation into the allegations. Clearly, that is a criminal investigation. It literally says it in the language, a criminal investigation. They may conduct an investigation into the allegations. It is clearly, those words give them the authority to continue the investigation after an investigation or prosecution has concluded. It is very clear in the language on 1.8, 1.9, and 1.10.
Representative O'Neill, this is not my bill, but I would say to you that the mere fact that someone committed a criminal act does not preclude that that individual also may have violated policy. It is fair practice to the accused in our state under our laws to make sure that those criminal charges are first adjudicated before we jump into the policy consideration in order to not prejudice that individual in the course of their criminal act. So you and I probably have a different interpretation of that, but that is my total understanding of our practice. I think it's a fair practice in terms of making sure that just because someone's a peace officer doesn't mean that they shouldn't have a fair day in court, free of other issues which do merit, but that those issues not prejudice the high stakes that may be involved in a criminal act.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one other quick comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill, I'm going to move forward, and if there's time, I will come back. You've had two questions. already and made a statement.
Just making up for lost time, Mr.
Trying to get you in, Representative O'Neill. You know I work hard to do that. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I know we have a whole other bill to get to as well.
Yes, we do.
So I just wanted to point out, we've heard a lot on, I think, from testifiers about the need for working closely with civilians. I haven't heard any objections to civilian oversight, and it seems, in fact, that the comments we've heard have been in favor of having civilians involved in oversight. We've also heard, comments about local control, local decision-making, and having elected officials have the ability to make decisions. The current law precludes cities from having effective local control if they would choose to go forward with that. And I think this bill really puts more control in the hands of local governments, more control in the hands of local elected officials to have effective civilian oversight. For those who would like to have civilian oversight that is advisory, the bill allows that, as Chair Mariani pointed out. For those who would like to have civilian oversight that goes into the disciplinary category, the bill allows for that too. So this really is a local control bill. If a jurisdiction wants to keep it advisory, they can. And I think this does meet the goals that folks have articulated of requiring civilian oversight, which we haven't heard objection to from anybody, but allowing local jurisdictions to have flexibility as far as that goes. So I think this strikes a really careful balance, and I just want to thank Representative Gomez for her hard work on trying to make sure we're having effective civilian oversight of our police.
Very well. Members, I will work hard to see if we can squeeze some more minutes out of this hearing, and so there are some things that still need to be commented on this bill. I will work to get back to for opportunity for that. I do want to thank everyone for a very strong debate. There are strong feelings here, and there should be. This is vitally important. Representative Gomez, any final words before we vote on your bill as amended?
Just thank the committee for their time, and really hope that we can think about how accountability is actually a cornerstone of any respectful relationship, whether it's a personal relationship or it's an institutional relationship. And so again, this isn't punitive. This is about how to actually have a functional relationship between law enforcement and community. So I thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your work on this bill, Representative Gomez. The chair renews his motion that House File 640 as amended be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. The clerk will take the roll.
Mariani.
Aye.
Mariani, aye. Frazier.
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Johnson.
No.
Johnson, no. Adelson.
Aye.
Adelson, aye. Feist.
Aye.
Feist, aye. Grissel. Excused. Hollins.
Aye.
Hollins, aye. Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Cleburne.
Aye.
Cleburne, aye. Long.
Aye.
Long, aye. Lucero.
Lucero, no.
Lucero, no. Mueller.
Mueller votes no.
Mueller, no. Novotny.
Novotny, no.
Novotny, no. O'Neill.
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Pinto.
Pinto, aye.
Pinto, aye. Poston.
No.
Poston, no. Rally.
Rally, no.
Rally, no. Vang.
Aye.
Vang, aye. Zhang.
Zhang, aye.
Zhang, aye. It's 11 ayes and 7 nays.
Very well. The members, on a vote of 11 ayes and 7 nays, House File 640 as amended is referred to the Committee on Judiciary. And members, thank you, Representative Gomez, and thank you to our testifiers, Ms. Grells, Chief Werner, and Sheriff Hutton. Members, the next bill before us is House File 75. And boy, I really wish that Mueller could just be the one who moves this, but she's not on our committee anymore. It's breaking my heart. And so I'm wondering if Representative Pinto would be so kind as to move to refer House File 75 to the Committee on State Government.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Pinto moves that House File 75 be referred to the Committee on State Government. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's great to be back here. I miss you all. I do, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment, and I don't know if you wanted to move that amendment before I go through the bill.
I think that makes sense. Representative Pinto, would you be so kind as to move the A3 amendment?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Pinto moves the A3 amendment. I take it Representative Mueller just puts the bill in the shape that you wish to have the bill before us. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Johnson, are you fine with a voice vote on this?
I am.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. All in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
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 All opposed, say no. Motion prevails. I jumped ahead of myself. Motion prevails. And the House File 75, as amended, stands before us. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I'm going to be really brief so we can get to the testifiers here, but House File 75, as amended, is the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Bill, and this has been coming before the legislature for years. We've heard a lot of really just awful stories about how our law currently is working, or in many cases isn't working. This bill has bipartisan support and the support of coalitions who often have very different views coming together. The current system really disproportionately impacts people of color and low-income folks. There's concerns about the way due process works under our current system and how proceeds of forfeiture are utilized. So now is the time, members, for us to enact these important reforms. And Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers, but just so we can save some time and they know the order, I believe the order will be Bob Small, Dan Kohler, Bill Hutton, Nora Sandstead, and Auditor Blaha. And I just ask my testifiers to really try to keep your remarks to about a minute so that we can get to a vote on this bill and get to member questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mueller, and welcome to the committee, Judge Small. Please state your name for the record and please provide us with your testimony, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Robert Small. I am the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. As Representative Mueller indicated, that this bill resulted from something that was rather unique in the sense that there was a clear indication that the legislature wanted to do something with respect to forfeiture reform. And we put together groups from both sides of this issue and had a mediation type session, which lasted for many, many months with many, many meetings. And the result of that is the legislation you have before you. It's not a perfect bill from the perspective of either side of the stakeholders that met on this, but they did reach a compromise, and that is what is in the bill. And we stand by that compromise. We appreciate the efforts of all of those who participated in the compromise negotiations, and particularly to Representative Mueller for bringing this matter forward. You'll hear details of the bill from an assistant county attorney who specializes in this area. And with that, I'd be available to stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you, Justice. I'm sorry. Is Nora Sandstead also part of your testimony?
Yes. She'll go over the details of the bill on a high level.
Very well. You did say that, but I wasn't sure. Very well. Ms. Sandstead, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Members of the committee, my name is Nora Sandstead. I'm an assistant St. Louis County attorney. I handle forfeiture matters for St. Louis County. We get several hundred a year, and I'm happy to stick around for any questions about the practicality of the differences here. But I just wanted to highlight the high-level changes that this bill would bring to the forfeiture practice. There's two main areas affected by this, DWI forfeiture and controlled substance forfeiture. And in terms of the changes to DWI forfeiture, the takeaways for you are that there are fewer crimes that result in vehicle forfeiture. We're restricting it to the most severe DWIs that would result in vehicle forfeiture. Felony DWIs, and then second degrees that are a third offense within 10 years. The bill also provides for an easier process for innocent owners to challenge a vehicle forfeiture. That is inspired by some recent case law and also just a general need for more due process protections for property owners. And the last element of the DWI change is lowering the cost for anyone who's challenging a forfeiture. There's going to be no filing fees involved, limits on storage fees that would be assessed, and no bonds in the interlock provision that was new in 2019. In terms of the changes to controlled substance forfeitures, the main takeaway is that there's a heightened standard for seizure of money that's considered to be drug proceeds. There is a restriction on vehicle seizures, limiting the seizure to vehicles used for drug sale rather than simply drug possession. And the bill also narrows the scope of property that's seized to that which is an instrument or tool of the crime or proceeds. The bill also includes enhanced reporting requirements, including for my office. We don't currently have to report unless law enforcement doesn't. We would be reporting on how forfeiture proceeds are used, as would law enforcement. That's the big change there. And then there's also a bit regarding federal sharing and a study on recidivism in this bill. So as Judge Small stated, the County Attorneys Association played a big role in this bill and is supportive of this compromise legislation, and I can remain available for questions as well.
Very well. Please go ahead, Judge Small. Thank you, Ms.
No, I mean, no.
Oh, okay. Got it. Thank you, Ms. Tansner, for walking through us those broad key elements of the changes that have been worked on. And so I believe next is Mr. Dan Kowler, and I'm sure I messed up your name. I apologize. Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, if you can come forward and state your name for the record and please provide your testimony. I'd appreciate it.
May it please the chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Kowler. I'm on the board of directors for the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, secretary for the Minnesota Society for Criminal Justice. We worked hard on this compromise bill. This has been a fight before this body for many years. I'm happy with the final result. Nobody got everything they wanted, but this is much needed reform in terms of our forfeiture scheme in Minnesota, the protections for innocent owners, and primarily we are eliminating a lot of the potentials for abuse that exist under the current law with the thresholds we've put into place with the heightened requirements for certain offenses. It's a cleaner bill for law enforcement to implement going forward. This is long overdue, and I'll keep my remarks at that, and I will be available for questions at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Kowler. Appreciate that. Next, we have Sheriff Bill Hutton of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association.
Good morning again, Chair Mariani, committee members. Thank you for allowing me to address the committee on House File 75. My name is Bill Hutton, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. Judge Small's already nailed it, as he always does, so it's always great to follow him. I just wanted the committee to know that the Sheriff's Association participated and was an active member of the group. Kudos to the County Attorneys Association for all the hard work that they put into this, as well as everybody else. But I want to go on record that the Minnesota Sheriff's Association supports the bill. And we also appreciate Representative Moeller for bringing the bill forward. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Sheriff, and thank you for to the association for participating in what initially was pretty tough work and pretty tough discussions, but it was vitally important to have all those stakeholders at the table. And then I believe Representative Moeller named Julie Blaha, our state auditor, as another testifier. So, State Auditor Blaha, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and please provide your testimony.
Chair Mariani and committee members, I'm State Auditor Julie Blaha. And with me today are two of our OSA researchers, John Jernberg and Christy John. They'll be available for questions. And as you know, the Office of the State Auditor oversees $40 billion in local government spending. And we do that through examinations, support, and analysis. Our analysis work comes into play today. As you may know, our office releases an annual report of the asset forfeitures governed by Minnesota statutes. Each year we track trends in the value of number and number of forfeitures, as well as types of property and crimes involved. And that's all based on data that law enforcement is required to provide us. I included the report in the committee materials, and you can also find it on our website. And there you can even get the raw data if you'd like to dig in deeper. Based on our data, we really believe that this bill starts the right conversation, particularly around small forfeitures. And I'm just going to skip right to our key numbers here. We found that in 2019, the net value of all forfeitures in the $1,500 and less category was about $1.5 million. Now, the average size of an individual forfeiture in that category was $473. And that category accounted for 75% of the forfeitures that resulted in proceeds that we monitored. Furthermore, these numbers have been pretty typical of what we've seen over the past 5 years. Proceeds from small forfeitures are at best a minor and unpredictable part of any public safety department's revenue stream. Total local government spending on police and sheriff services in 2019 was just over $1.7 billion. That means small forfeitures accounted for only about 0.4% of those budgets. Now, changes in such a small fraction of a budget are manageable. In fact, that's something the state could easily offset, which is always a good idea when legislation impacts local budgets, but that's for another committee. On the other hand, we all know that if a low-income person experiences a forfeiture of even a few hundred dollars, that impact could be catastrophic. So, small forfeitures offer minimal financial benefit at the system level and a disproportionately negative impact on individuals at a lower income levels. So, restricting small forfeitures will have big benefits with little costs. Now, one caveat, of course, the most common criminal activities leading to forfeiture, seizure, and final disposition of property in 2019 were DUI-related and controlled substance-related. That accounts for 94% of the forfeitures. So we will need to temper our expectations on the overall impact of these specific restrictions. And also on a technical note, we appreciate the consideration given to oversight in the bill. Always works best when we consider it early. And so we're ready to deal with the reporting updates. We appreciate the idea of audits described on starting on line 24.4. We believe that we can examine or review the procedures referenced here without the specific language in the bill. And so we've been talking to stakeholders and the authors to find a way to possibly eliminate that portion, the audit section. We believe we can still ensure that people have a recourse if there's a concern. But if we take that out, it would cut the cost of this bill by about $160,000 per year. Again, we're happy to conduct the audits that you ask, but removing that section may be more cost effective, and we'll pursue that. We've been talking about that for potentially for future meetings. But again, thank you. This is absolutely the right conversation to have, and we appreciate how you're using data to improve forfeiture in Minnesota. And we'll be available for questions if needed.
Thank you, State Auditor Maha. I do have one other person listed to provide testimony, Mr. Lee McGrath, the Managing Attorney of the Institute for Justice. Welcome to the committee, Mr. McGrath. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony. And before you do that, very quickly, members, we do have three members with questions. I'll work to get through those three. I do want us to get to the Quam bill and to hear from Mr. John and Denise Klaus, Mr. and Ms. John and Denise Klaus, as well as Mr. Brian Peters. So giving everyone a heads up. But with that, please, Mr. McGrath, come forward.
Chairman Mariani, thank you very much, and members of the committee. My name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice, a public interest law firm that is the nation's leading advocate for forfeiture reform. I wanted to build on State Auditor Blaha's comments to point out that there are some illusory fixes in this legislation that the committee, and I'm happy to work with the author, the committee and the author should address. Auditor Blaha is right to characterize the forfeitures in Minnesota as numerous and small. There are about 8,000 forfeitures that occur a year, about 20 a day. And the average currency forfeiture is only about $600. The average, when you include cars, it goes up to about $1,700. The committee should not be view what happens in Minnesota through a lens of large forfeitures and drug mules being pulled over. In fact, only seven forfeitures were greater than $50,000, and the largest one was $80,000. So this is a lot of people who have a small amount of money seized from them. And this is why it is so important to address one of the shortcomings in the bill, which is in regard to a threshold amount of $1,500. Unfortunately, that threshold is illusory because it doesn't stop the seizure of cash from occurring. Committee is so prone to dive into the details. It can be seen on line 15.12, the use of the word or there is probable cause to believe. This is not a threshold at all. This is a recodification of a probable cause standard, a standard that is universal in all seizures. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, the other concern is the back door of the federal government. There is an attempt, but an illusory one, to close that back door to forfeiture seizures being sent to the U.S. attorney, and that's on page 13. On line 13.15, the bill speaks to circumventing state law. Well, that is not how federal law works. Federal law has its own criminal code. Federal law has its own forfeiture for code. You wouldn't be circumventing state law if you called up the U.S. attorney and participated in the equitable sharing program. You would be using a completely different set of laws. It's a completely different jurisdiction. You'd be using the federal jurisdiction. So here again, this restraint on forfeiture is illusory. Mr. Chairman, if I can just give you a sense of that, in the city of St. Paul, there's approximately $500,000 a year that is seized and forfeited. And more than half of that is done through federal programs. So I submit that although well-intentioned to address the real problem that State Auditor Blaha rightly points out, this bill comes up short. I'd be happy to answer both questions about that.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Thank you for your work on this, being at the table, and for working with Representative Mulder. I think you gave us a glimpse of just some of the complexities and difficulties faced by the group. Let's move quickly to our three, and then we're going to go to a vote. Representative Edelson, Representative Long, and then Representative Johnson. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair, and I'll keep my comments quick. I just want to thank Representative Mulder and all the stakeholders. This bill came before us last year in public safety, and a very different version, some great compromises, and I just want to thank all of you. A lot of work went into this bill, you can tell, so thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Like most compromises, still leaving a lot of folks a bit uncomfortable, no doubt, but good work. Representative Long, you dropped off. Is that correct?
No, I
you're still there
because I thought you were coming to me next.
All right, Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. I was just going to ask Assistant County Attorney Sandstead to clarify the point that Mr. McGrath made. He raised the point about having a having probable cause, there is a change in the probable cause standard from current law, and I thought it would be helpful for the committee to hear.
Ms. Stanford, please.
Yes, thank you for that question. There is a change. Existing law requires probable cause to conclude that there's proximity between any property seized and controlled substances. And this law would require probable cause to believe that the property seized is actually the proceeds of a drug offense or an instrument thereof. So that's a significant difference from our perspective.
Okay, very well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, Representative.
Mulder.
Mulder, I want to thank you for bringing the bill forward. I understand there's a compromise. And to be honest, I have no problem with the DUI part of it. We have kept adding more and more aggravated offenses which actually increase the number of forfeitures availability. And that was an unintended consequence of what the legislators did, increasing aggravating factors. But I do have an issue with the drug part of it. I've worked drug cases for many years not only as a patrol officer and a police officer, but also as a narcotics investigator working undercover narcotics, along with, Representative Grosslaw, we also did that. But what we found is every time the dollar amount for forfeiture was raised, the people that were carrying the funds always kept under that amount on them. And now we're allowing more and more dollars to go to the cartel down in Mexico and Central America. For every dollar that we seize here is about $50 to $70 of narcotics not coming to the streets of Minnesota. And Minnesota is now the hub for the five-state area. So that's the issue I have on the drug issue. That's why I can't support it. But also, as the Mr. McGrath brought up the federal issue, I've worked federal cases. In order to get a federal case in there and do the federal forfeiture, you need a federal agent working with you on that case. A local narcotics or a local officer that is doing a drug case, unless the federal government and the federal agency is working with you, whether it's DEA or I've actually had FBI help me out on a couple cases, you cannot get a case into federal court. And the issue with down in Minneapolis with the larger number of federal, or St. Paul, they said, with the federal forfeitures, we have the airport and the buses and stuff. That is where the drugs are coming into Minnesota, into St. Paul area. that's why those numbers are as high as they are in the federal cases, because the federal government is actually working those areas on the with through DEA and as well as customs to end the trafficking of narcotics into this state. And that's why those numbers are at that level. So I thought I'd get that information out. I also had one more thing to add as far as the levels of forfeiture. I hate to put the county attorneys under the bus, but my county attorney actually did it. He set parameters of for our area for vehicles, especially on the DWI, the value of the vehicle and other things before he would even accept a forfeiture case. If we did it without outside those parameters, the forfeiture is dropped, then the person got their property back. And that's something county attorneys can do, is what their area would allow. They can do that now without this bill tying the hands of law enforcement on certain cases, because they deal with the same people time after time after time. If you get the same person selling a small amount, keep that $1,499, or should we start going after them harder to make sure that that money?
Oh, shit.
Very well. Representative Johnson, I try not to interrupt, but I think we might have lost you, or you all might have lost me, but I think it's the other way around.
I had concluded.
Oh, there you go. Okay. All right. Representative Johnson, thank you for the information. Thank you for also, quite frankly, the reminder of the ways in which discretion that our county attorneys can be helpful in terms of pushing forward de facto policy within the law that serves a good purpose. And thank you for the work that you've done. By the way, in the past, high risk work, no doubt. Representative Mueller, we're ready to for your closing comments, and then we'll go to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to address Representative Johnson's comments about the probable cause concern, I just would remind members to look at line 15.12, that it's the total value of $1,500 or more if there is probable cause to believe that the money was exchanged. So I just remind him to look at that. But I certainly appreciate his comments and all the work of the various stakeholders on this bill. And also just to point out that in your packets, members, there are two documents. One has a list of all the different organizations that worked on the bill, and then the other is a letter of support. With that, Mr. Chair, I have no other comments, and I'm excited for the vote. Thank you.
Very well. You've got a journey ahead of you, assuming this bill keeps moving. Members, Representative Pinto renews his motion that House File 75 as amended be referred to the Committee on State Government. The clerk will take the roll.
Mariani.
Aye.
Mariani, aye. Frazier.
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Johnson.
No.
Johnson, no. Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Feist.
Aye.
Feist, aye. Grossel, excused. Hollins. Collins. Hewitt.
Hewitt, aye.
Hewitt, aye. Cleburne.
Cleburne, aye.
Cleburne, aye. Long.
Aye.
Long, aye. Lucero.
Lucero's a yes.
Lucero, aye. Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Mueller, yes. Novotny.
Yes.
Novotny, yes. O'Neill.
O'Neill, aye.
O'Neill, aye. Pinto.
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Poston.
Aye.
Poston, aye. Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Vane.
Aye.
Vang, aye. Zhang.
Aye.
Zhang, aye.
Hollins is here. I vote aye.
Okay. I was going to come back to you, but
sorry.
Great. Thanks. Hollins, aye. Seventeen ayes, one nay.
Very well. Members, on vote 17 ayes and one nay, House File 75, as amended, is referred to the Committee on State Government. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Thank you for all the testimonies, all the people who have worked awfully hard on this issue. Representative Johnson?
Chair Mariani, members, and to the public, there's been a lot of things going on being said that I don't about law enforcement, not only in Minneapolis, but across the state. I had, at my request, our administrator, Mr. Lundy, posted a letter to the editor from one of the Minneapolis police officers that was involved during the riots in Minneapolis. I ask that everybody take an opportunity to read it. It gives a perspective of what the officers went through and some of the issues that they had to deal with. So some of the members get an understanding of what's actually going on from the different side of point of view. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Members, we're going to push the clock a bit here until they kick us out. But I do want to honor Representative Quam's bill hearing, particularly since he has constituents with him. And so I think the quicker we can get to their part of the testimony, the better. I would ask, however, for the testifiers to be as succinct as possible, because I certainly don't want us to all of a sudden have the plug pulled on us here. This bill it will be laid over for possible inclusion, and so we won't be voting on it. But nonetheless, I think it's important to get the testimony in. So, members, the chair is going to move House File 237 laying over for possible consideration in the eventual committee omnibus bill. This is always an awkward motion. Representative Quam, the point is that your bill is now officially before us. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just before the pandemic changed things, there was a hearing on this, and it's one of those bills where it'd be great if this was not brought about by a tragedy, but the testifiers will explain how this can help make a difference and help us learn from an unfortunate event. And Mr. Chair, if the testifiers could go. Thank you.
Very well. Welcome, John and Denise Klaus. You were with us last year, and I know I speak on behalf of the committee at that time. Our heartfelt sympathies and empathy for you. But please come forward and tell us your story.
Hi, thank you, Chairman Mariani and committee members, for this opportunity to speak with you again. My name is John Klaus. My wife, Denise, and I live in Orinoco, just north of Rochester. I think it is necessary for me to explain to you why we originally approached our legislators about this legislation. I will speak quickly. I know time is of pressure, but I really want to say what I want to say. So. Our son Matthew lived in Rochester. He had a good job that he enjoyed and earned an associate's degree in finance at RCTC and has a 14-year-old son that he loves. He struggled for a long time with substance abuse. His addiction caused legal problems, resulting with time in county jail, rehab, sober living. In January 2019, he had been sober for 14 months. In February, he confided to me that he was struggling, that he relapsed, was drinking heavily, and even used heroin again, but he said he had a plan. On March 30th, 2019, almost 2 years ago, I found Matthew dead in his home. He was 32 years old. Toxicology reports confirmed our suspicion. Cause of death was heroin with a fentanyl overdose. Several days after he died, as our family gathered together to grieve and plan, my daughter received a text message from a friend pointing us to a post-bulletin story. An arrest was made regarding Matthew's death. The post-bulletin and KTTC-TV both reported that the dealer that sold Matthew the heroin had been arrested. They also reported that Matthew was working as a confidential informant for the Rochester Police Department. Matt had bought a fatal dose of heroin laced with fentanyl from the same dealer that he was buying from in his role as confidential informant for the RPD. We were stunned. News media was aware of this before we were, a shock on top of the tragedy that we're already dealing with. I called RPD, who sent out a detective that was working on Matthew's death. He confirmed everything we heard and put us in contact with the narcotics officer that was working with Matt. He talked about many things. In summary, we were told that Matt approached them to be a confidential informant. He told them that he wanted to help RPD get drug dealers off the streets so that word would get out that he was a CI preventing him from buying drugs. Wow. Shortly after his death, several stories and editorials were written by the Star Tribune and Rochester's Post Bulletin. They brought to our attention information about the dangers to the sobriety of an addict when they serve as confidential informants. We realized that work needed to be done to better protect addicts in recovery or not when helping law enforcement. Our research highlighted 3 points. One, the use of confidential informants is critical for law enforcement to do their job in protecting the community against drugs and other crime. CIs can do things that trained law enforcement is unable to do. Two, there's an inherent risk to an addict, in recovery or not, when buying drugs as a CI. There's a danger to their sobriety when the dealer puts heroin into their hands and then is required to turn it over to law enforcement. The danger is not always understood by the addict, nor by the law enforcement, nor by anyone else not familiar with chemical dependency problems. Three, there tends to be secrecy by law enforcement and their policies regarding the use of confidential informants. They don't want to be constrained in how they operate, and they state that transparency in their policies would provide operating methods and techniques to bad people, compromising their ability to effectively use CIs. They also do not publish information on how often they employ CIs, nor any results, good, bad, or catastrophic. We notice there is no standard policy for law enforcement's use of confidential informants in Minnesota. We were provided by copies of RPD's confidential informant use policy and cooperating individual agreement forms by a reporter. The policy is less than 2 pages long, and the policy states, the purpose of this policy is to establish guidelines for the safe and effective utilization of confidential informants. There is little that actually addresses safety, and those references are very vague as to how. I believe that law enforcement understands how to provide physical safety for a CI, but I believe that safety with respect to relapse and sobriety is not understood, if even a concern. One policy item states, officers shall not utilize a person on parole or probation as a CI unless established and agreed upon protocols with community corrections are followed. Matt was on probation, but his PO was never informed. Just prior to Matt's death, I had called Matt's PO on 2 occasions, as well as calling RPD for a welfare check on Matt. I told him that Matt was using again, urged him to get help for Matt. Sadly, if the PO had been informed by RPD about using Matt to buy drugs, he may have remembered my calls and worked a plan for Matt. The cooperating individual agreement is a similar document that is merely has the CI acknowledge that RPD provides no benefits to the CI and seems to exist purely to absolve RPD from any liability. I'll skip a little bit. Denise and I want to acknowledge that the use of addicts as CIs is probably necessary for law enforcement. We are not advocating to stop this process. We realize that law enforcement has a difficult job and protecting our communities is vital. What we're asking for in exchange for the valuable services that CIs provide, law enforcement puts in place protections offering to help get the CI into sobriety or be able to stay sober if that is what they wish. We believe that this can be done without hindering law enforcement's ability to use them. This bill that Representative Quam has introduced does not specify a policy. It instructs professionals from both law enforcement and mental health substance abuse counseling communities to create a policy that allows law enforcement to continue the work while offering protection for the person taking the risks. This is not a new problem. There are model policies and model agreements already in existence. I've come to believe that addicts should be considered vulnerable adults. They should be treated as valuable employees and not disposable assets. They should be offered access to an advocate whose primary role is for their safety. Responsibilities would include explaining risks to the CI, assessing the CI to determine risk of relapse before, during, and after the use. A person that the CI can talk to as a counselor. In Matt's case, a trained advocate would have picked up on signs that Matt knew his sobriety would be at risk. The CI should have access to health care, including treatment, as would any employee. There should be an emergency contact provided. We should not have learned about Matt's role from the internet. We realize there are details that need to be worked out by the post board when the policy is actually written. We realize that not all CIs want or think they need an advocate. Some simply want to be paid. But there are people like Matt that recognize their need for help. The narcotics officer told me personally that many CIs make their services available not for money, but they think this will help them. We need trained people to recognize those cases in a policy and how to handle them properly. Offering the CI an advocate and making one available seems reasonable. The state should have oversight in the use of confidential informants. Matt's death would have gone without inspection except for news reporters. Video footage in which Rochester Citizen Oversight Committee questioned RPD about the original Star Tribune article was very disappointing. There were no questions that asked for details about what happened, no requests for case notes, only a question about whether their policy was followed. A policy that has no substance except for the requirement to work with Matt's PO, a policy item that was violated. We are not aware of any follow-up investigation by RPD or any other agency, no acknowledgement that a tragedy had happened, nor discussions of what might have been done to avoid this in the future. If this is typical, then oversight is necessary. Also, an important part of the bill is that all law enforcement agencies in Minnesota are expected to adopt the new policy. I was a bit worried about pushback on this item, and I guess I still am. However, after our last testimony before this committee, Brian Peters, Executive Director of Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, introduced himself to us. Since then, we've had many conversations. He had arranged for meetings which resulted in minor adjustments being made to the original version of the bill. I'm very confident in his support. In fact, he has frequently encouraged me to keep up our efforts. This is not a police bashing bill. I want to be clear on that. We're not trying to find fault with or blame anyone for Matt's death. Law enforcement has a difficult job to do, but we should learn from tragedies and try to fix problems. If a better policy existed and its use was in practice, I believe it's likely Matt would still be here today. Finally, it was suggested to me I explain some of the difficulties we've had in our efforts getting this bill heard. Our initial contact with Representative Klama, Senator Senjan, over 1 year ago made us hopeful, but we went through periods of discouragement. Navigating the complexities of how legislation gets done is complicated. Between the House and Senate, various committees, all requiring access to people that we need to somehow get the attention of. Access to legislators has been difficult. Everyone seems to want a piece of their time. I was told that people often give up and that many people hire attorneys or someone to lobby for them. We don't have any special interest group behind the scenes. We don't have a pile of money to pay for access. Just Denise and I, with friends and family encouraging us to keep working. It has been almost a year since Denise and I last testified here. Unforeseeable events cause us to pause our efforts, but we are still trying. We constantly struggle with how hard to press people. Emails and phone calls not getting returned by legislators and staff are the norm, not the exception. We get despaired when it seems like no one is listening. We are committed to this bill. I'm not a naive person. I realize that in the big picture, this is a bill with small impact. But Matthew's Law is a good bill, is a fair bill, is a common sense bill, and it is certainly not a partisan bill. Our goal is to simply pass a bill that offers protections to vulnerable people in a way that still allows law enforcement to protect the greater community. Addiction is a horrible disease. We should help those that want help, especially if they are risking themselves for the benefit of the community. If we can save one person from ending up like Matt, if we can save one person from relapsing, if we can save one family from going through the tragedy that ours has, then our efforts and frustration will have been worth it. The best way for us to honor Matt's memory is to pass this bill and enact a good policy. Thank you again to the committee for this opportunity to speak. I apologize if I provided more detail than necessary. If I've talked longer than my allocated time, I'd be happy to talk happy to provide more details or discuss this further with anyone that wishes. And I would like to especially publicly thank Representative Quam for his support this past year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klaus. We are humbled by your presence and more importantly, by your work on an important issue. I do know, members, that a couple of states that passed legislation similar to this, I believe Florida is one, and I think North Dakota, one of our neighbor states, recently passed something like this. It is important that we work out some technical issues, and so that's why I want to, you know, get us the time to do that. I think Mr. Peters is here. If he is, I'd ask him to come forward. But if you could just be super quick, that'd be really helpful.
Mr. Chairman, my wife wanted to speak too real quick, if that's okay.
Yes, Mr. Klaus, why don't we see if Mr. Peters is here really quick first.
Okay.
Yeah. Chair Mariani, yes, I am here.
Please, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee. I'll be very brief. John really said it well. We met over a year ago at the testimony, and we've been working together, staying in touch this entire year to move this forward. I understand there were some tweaks that we need to make, off some suggestions from the BCA, and John and I have talked about it with Denise as well, and we'll continue to tweak it until we get it right. So the MPPOA is in full support in making sure that we can come to an agreement on language and move it forward. Thank you.
Very well, thank you. I apologize. I should have asked you to formally announce yourself for the record. So if you could take a second to do that, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, Chair, I should have known better on that as well. My name is Brian Peters. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. Thank you.
Very well, thank you, Mr. Peters. And members, let me make a technical correction here. I am a little rusty. The appropriate motion is to move House File 237 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. What I did was move my intention, so we will be laying this over, but I just wanted, for the record, make sure that the bill is appropriately before us, and that therefore means when we lay it over, assuming that we'll be able to move it forward, we'll have the appropriate setup for it to be able to do that. So the chair amends his motion that to be House File 237 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Quam, we do have Ms. Klaus who wishes to speak. I barely want to do that, but I also know we only have a few seconds left. And so perhaps, Ms. Klaus, I hate to rush a parent who's lost a child. Your son, I was doing the math, is pretty close to, would have been pretty close to my son's age right now, and I just cannot. I can't express enough deep sympathies to you, but if you could present yourself and share just some very quick words. I know that's hard, but if you would, I would certainly appreciate it.
My name is Denise Klaus. Thank you, Chairman Mariani and committee members, for allowing me to speak. On March 30th, we lost our son Matthew from an accidental overdose. This occurred while Matthew was helping the RPD as a confidential informant. We only found out that he was an informant from a friend who saw it in the news. We were not even given the consideration of a phone call from the police department to give us advanced warning that his death would be announced in the news because of his role as an informant. If there had been a policy in effect that was written to protect the informant, Matthew might still be here today, and his family and many friends would not be grieving him still. I want anyone acting as an informant to be treated with the respect that any employee would be given. These are people who have families and friends that care about them. In the case of addicts, they have a disease. They should not have to sign away their rights while they help the police do their job, which is what Matthew had to do. They should not be used and tossed aside. They are providing a valuable service to their community at a risk to themselves. Their well-being, both physical and mental, should be an important consideration in this process. And that is why I think that they should have an advocate. In some cases, the CI is helping in order to get a reduction of charges. Sometimes they want or need the money. And in Matthew's case, he wanted to help get the dealer off the street, help his sobriety. But no matter the reason, the risk is the same for all of them. I'm asking that you look seriously at this bill and help to protect the safety and rights of future informants. Matthew was a son, a father, a brother, and a friend. And a bill like this would have better protected him. And maybe we all wouldn't be still grieving him today. Thank you for allowing me the time to speak to you. And thank you to Representative Quam for taking up this issue and helping us put this bill together. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Klaus. And I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank you for the courage to work on this along with your husband and Representative Quam. Representative Johnson, you're going to get the last word here, I think. I saw your hand up really quickly, but maybe it's still up. And then I'll make my motion to lay this over.
Chair Mariani, members, Representative Quam, John and Denise Klaus, I'm sorry for your loss. I understand the concept of this bill. What makes me upset is that the department did not have a policy. In 1995, when I was working Drug Task Force, we had a policy. Our department had a policy. And what's the interesting part is the stuff that it's in this bill is in my current or my former department's policy right now. I think it's, I'm not sure if we have to have a bill to do this. I think it's education for these departments to make sure that they have these things in and for the officers to be trained in how to use them. In our department, or my former department, a deputy cannot even use a CI without an investigator involved. So I don't know what happened down in Rochester. I do know that we do everything we can to keep the officer and the public and the informant safe, but we have no control over the informants if they go behind our backs. I've actually had one of my informants arrested for violating, for drug possession while he's working for me. We cut ties and that was the end of it. You could no longer be an informant. Those are things that we work on. We do what we can to keep everybody safe, but unfortunately it doesn't always work out as we've seen time after time after time. But I do like the concept of this, but I think it's more of education for the departments to make sure that they have the policies in place. Not sure if we have to do it statutorily, but with education through the Chiefs of the Police Association and Sheriff's Association, just making recommendations to them, I believe that they would come forward. And there's good policies out there. In fact, Lexi Poole has a fabulous one that's even more strict than I had back in 1995. So thank you. And again, to the classes, sorry for your loss.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Quam, I want to encourage you to continue to work on this bill, work with the MPPOA and the BCA, probably for an amendment to just some of the technical issues that we haven't had the time to raise up yet, but we will when the bill comes back up. Thank you so much for bringing us this bill, and thank you, Mr. John Klaus and Ms. Denise Klaus, for being with us today. I speak, I believe, on behalf of the entire committee in sharing our deep love and condolences to you and to your family. Members, with that, the chair lays House File 237 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And members, until next week, this committee stands adjourned. Have a good weekend.